This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the February 2026 issue of Arizona Highways. Matt Jaffe is the author of On the Third Day She Rose Again. When evangelist Amy Semple McPherson vanished near Venice Beach, it made headlines and drew massive crowds. When she resurfaced near Douglas, Arizona, 3 days after her funeral, it made headlines again and awakened a sleepy town that opened its arms and believed every word she said. Prosecutors in California, however, weren't so easily convinced. A few hours before a summer dawn, evangelist Amy Semple McPherson walked out of the Chihuahuan Desert and came back from the dead. 5 weeks earlier, on May 18, 1926, McPherson, one of Southern California's most famous women, had vanished while swimming near Venice Beach. Her followers held daily vigils along the shore as the ocean search failed to locate McPherson's body. Although the Los Angeles coroner refused to issue a death certificate, 12,000 mourners gathered on June 20th for memorial services at McPherson's Angelus Temple. 3 days later, and 600 miles away, the custodian of a slaughterhouse on the border near Douglas, Arizona, in Agua Prieta, Mexico, was sleeping outside. Awakened by his dogs, he saw a distraught woman on the Mexican side. Despite his pleas for her to come through the border fence for help on the U.S. side, the woman began walking more than a mile toward Agua Prieta. Then she collapsed at the home of local bar owner Ramon Gonzalez and his wife Teresa. It wasn't until jittery driver Johnny Anderson arrived to take the mystery woman to a Douglas area hospital that it became clear who she was. Desperately clinging to Anderson, the woman declared she was Amy Semple McPherson and that more than 12 hours earlier she had escaped kidnappers in Mexico and fled to the desert. Thus began one of the most famous events in Douglas history. In the preceding days, the Douglas Daily Dispatch had published the kinds of articles typically found in a small-town newspaper. There was a tragic, a Douglas man suffocated when his Ford Roadster overturned and crushed him, as well as the lighthearted, including the headline, Rancher Ropes Porcupine at Mud Springs. A splendid bill of vaudeville was set for G Street's Grand Theater, while the Douglas Blues baseball team languished in fourth place in the Copper League. When the outside world learned McPherson was alive, Douglas, population 9,000 plus, became ground zero for a media frenzy supercharged by the emerging medium of radio, the rise of celebrity culture, and the intense competition among the more than 2,000 daily newspapers published in the United States during the 1920s. The story had it all. Kidnapping, a famous woman in deadly peril, a miraculous resurrection, the border, hints of sex and infidelity, financial shenanigans, and two irreconcilable perspectives, the skepticism of those who doubted McPherson and the fervor of both her true believers and the star-struck masses. Each day atop its front page, the Dispatch ran a banner touting Douglas as the second largest city on the southern United States border and the gateway to Sonora, the treasure house of Mexico. By 1920, Douglas was a prosperous town where two smelters processed copper ore from the mines of Bisbee. Opened in 1907, the stately Gadsden Hotel, with its marble lobby and 160 rooms, ranked with Arizona's finest. More than 30 freight and passenger trains rumbled through town daily, and border crossings rose sharply as Americans flocked to the nightclubs of Agua Prieta after the 1920 advent of Prohibition. With their close economic and cultural ties and geographic isolation, Douglas and Agua Prieta mostly functioned like a single city. But during the Mexican Revolution, gunshots, explosions, and bugle calls echoed through Douglas's streets as townspeople watched major battles in Agua Prieta from their rooftops. And the unsettled situation in Mexico led the U.S. Army to establish Camp Henry J. Jones to guard against potential raids by Pancho Villa's forces. McPherson's reappearance set off an invasion of a different kind. Reporters descended from hundreds of miles away. Both the Los Angeles Times and the Los Angeles Examiner flew in reporters and photographers who quickly turned back around to deliver their exclusive images. The New York Times ran front page articles, and newspapers in cities as distant as Sydney, Australia, published McPherson's account. The data was primitive but telling. More than 100,000 words went out over the western Union Telegraph, and at least 400 telephone calls were placed between Douglas and the West Coast. There was quite a story to tell. In McPherson's narrative, a man and a woman, whom she later called Mexicali Rose, approached her at the beach. They pleaded with the evangelist to minister to their dying baby in a nearby automobile. When McPherson approached the car, while still in her beach attire, they subdued her with chloroform. Hours later, McPherson came to in a desert shack. She saw a third abductor, she said, and claimed the kidnappers tortured her with a lit cigar. After 4 weeks, they took her to a second shack, where a few days later they left McPherson alone. She said she rolled across the floor to reach a large tin can and used its lid's jagged edges to saw through the ropes that bound her hands. She untied her ankles and then set out across a desert thick with mesquites, cactuses, and catclaw. Temperatures hovered around 100 degrees before nightfall, and McPherson continued through rugged desert lit only by the moon. She covered more than 20 miles, a journey the dispatch vividly described, wandering, running, falling, exhausted, only to writhe in fright, stumbling to her feet in unimaginable horror as whirring noises brought to her mind the thought of the dread rattlers of Mexico, the night birds of Mexico that flew from mesquite bushes and about her head drove her frantic, every sound a horror, every horror bringing the ice-cold finger of dread and fear to her heart. Even as she neared safety, McPherson found no relief, the paper added. The glaring red lights of Douglas's copper smelters made her dream of inferno. As word spread that McPherson was at the hospital, crowds gathered, whispering and wondering how Douglas was selected by fate for the resurrection, according to the dispatch. But questions quickly arose. When she found help, McPherson was neither sweaty nor sunburned. Her lips weren't chapped, and according to Teresa Gonzalez, she didn't ask for water until an hour after she showed up. An examination revealed minor wounds on McPherson's wrists and some blisters and cactus needles on her feet, but not the injuries one might expect to suffer during a trailless desert trek. Her gray dress was clean and her black leather slippers showed little wear. She wore a corset, an odd item for kidnappers to provide her and for her to leave on in the desert heat. McPherson also mentioned the shack from which she had escaped had a wooden floor, an uncommon feature in a region where most buildings still had earthen floors. Mexican and Douglas law enforcement, along with posses of townspeople and even local schoolboys, fanned out to search for the shack. McPherson joined in too, but no shack matching her description was found. When she emerged from the desert, McPherson was 35 and at the peak of fame after the long journey from the Ontario, Canada apple farm where she had grown up. Her mother, Minnie Kennedy, was a devoted member of the Salvation Army and had introduced McPherson to the religious life at an early age. The young McPherson had a vivid imagination and theatrical flair, and she staged church services with toys as her congregation. At 17, McPherson traveled by sleigh into town with her father, then persuaded him to attend a Pentecostal revival meeting led by Irish evangelist Robert Semple. Listening to Semple, McPherson recalled, "Cold shivers ran up and down my neck. The night," she added, "was the turning point of my life." She not only had a religious awakening, but immediately fell in love with Semple. 2 months shy of her 18th birthday, the couple married, and in 1910 they sailed for China to serve as missionaries. But shortly after arriving, they came down with malaria. Robert, who also contracted dysentery, died. Their daughter, Roberta, was born 29 days after Robert's death. Back in the U.S., McPherson remarried, then gave birth to her son, Rolf, in 1913, before her religious passions inspired her to hit the road. "I took my suitcase and my babies, and I started off in the night, got a taxi cab, and went to the depot," she recalled. "Started off to preach the word of God. I was invited to this town and that town. Perched outdoors under the trees, preached in the piazza, preached on the street corner. I preached from Canada clear to Key West, Florida, by winter and summer, in tents or in open air." Wearing her trademark white nurse's dress with a military cape, McPherson crisscrossed the country 6 times in 7 years. Traveling with the children, she and Kennedy drove an 8-cylinder Oldsmobile dubbed the Gospel Car and emblazoned with the question, "Where will you spend eternity?" At night, they knelt on the running board and prayed. During a time when female preachers were controversial, McPherson filled huge auditoriums around the country. She then saw her future in booming Los Angeles, where she arrived in 1918 with $10 cash and a tambourine. She toured to raise funds for a house of worship for her Foursquare church, and in 1923, she opened the Angelus Temple. She preached salvation, not damnation, and the temple, a gigantic indoor Roman amphitheater considered the country's first megachurch, was designed to uplift her followers. Painted blue to resemble the sky and complete with billowing cumulus clouds, the dome shimmered with bits of abalone shell. McPherson said, "I wanted it like God's own outdoors." A pair of radio antennae rose from the roof. McPherson recognized how radio could help her save souls far beyond Southern California, and she became one of the first women in the United States to acquire a radio license. In 1924, she launched KFSG and became a pioneer of electronic evangelism. McPherson produced Hollywood-style spectacles she called illustrated sermons. One featured cannons fired from a full-size sailing ship, another a Trojan horse. There was a 100-voice choir, bell ringers, an 80-piece xylophone band, and even live lions, tigers, and camels. She once took the stage dressed as a traffic cop on a motorcycle and delivered a sermon urging congregants to slow down long enough to be saved. A Los Angeles newspaper wrote, "If Amy Semple McPherson had not chosen to be a revivalist, she could have been a queen of musical comedy. She has magnetism such as few women since Cleopatra have possessed." Douglas swooned during McPherson's recovery. Flowers sent by locals filled her room, and McPherson proposed building a Douglas branch of the Angelus Temple to thank the community for its kindness. The Dispatch promoted her account of the kidnapping and ran unverified reports that the mystery shack had been found. In a gushing front-page note, McPherson wrote, "The friendships here, I feel sure, will be sincere and lasting. The friendship born in the heat of an hour welds and forges sacred bonds." Before boarding the 9:10 p.m. Southern Pacific train for Los Angeles, she bade Douglas farewell at a prayer meeting attended by 5,000 people at 10th Street Park. The city didn't hesitate to promote its connections to McPherson. The Chamber of Commerce produced stickers declaring, "Amy slept here," while Anderson, the cab driver, lured passengers with the promise of riding in the same vehicle that carried McPherson to safety as the Dispatch trumpeted, "All aboard the Amy McPherson Douglas Special." We all gave Mrs. McPherson the benefit of the doubt, and in so doing, endeared ourselves and our city to her, the newspaper declared. We all did ourselves proud. Why? First, because this town is made up of hospitable people. A crowd of 30,000 greeted McPherson when her train rolled into Los Angeles, but a happy homecoming proved short-lived. A grand jury began to investigate whether she had committed criminal conspiracy. There were too many holes in her story, too many reports of sightings everywhere from Edmonton to Tucson, as well as accounts of her traveling freely in Mexico. More damning evidence suggested that, starting the day after her disappearance, McPherson had shacked up for 10 days in a Carmel, California cottage with Kenneth G. Ormiston, the Angelus Temple's radio operator. The grand jury extended the McPherson drama for several more months. Douglas locals testified, and prominent officials, including the mayor, issued a statement declaring they believed McPherson's story. But Mexican officials had doubts from the start, especially about footprints found outside Agua Prieta that matched McPherson's shoes. If she did make them, then she could not have been wandering around all over the desert here, argued Agua Prieta politician Ernesto Bubion. But would have been the passenger in an automobile. McPherson, her mother, and Ormiston were eventually indicted, but in January 1927, the Los Angeles District Attorney suddenly dropped all charges, believing a guilty verdict was unattainable. McPherson, having survived the scandal, continued her work until she died of an accidental barbiturate overdose in 1944 at age 53. Her son Rolf then guided the ministry for 44 years, and the Foursquare Church has grown to nearly 9 million members in 150 countries. But Amy Semple McPherson never did fulfill her vow to build a church in Douglas. nor did she ever come back to town. And this concludes, on the third day, she rose again. Kathy Montgomery is the author of Be Simple. Referring to principles such as freedom and justice, Winston Churchill said, "All the great things are simple, and while it wouldn't be fair to compare a meal, however good, to those lofty virtues, it's true that Prescott's Be Simple has elevated the humble breakfast. Its generous portions and Southwest-inspired menu have won over Prescott diners, who voted the tiny cafe best breakfast in the Quad Cities area the past 2 years. Doug Weckerly and his wife Laura opened Be Simple in a small, unassuming space in 2020. Weckerly, who launched popular restaurant chains in New Mexico and Colorado, built Be Simple's menu on the same elements that made his earlier restaurants beloved. Butter browns, his take on hash browns, and large, fluffy biscuits with house-made jams. We're known for our browns and our biscuits, says Jose Sanchez, who bought Be Simple with his wife, Catherine Velasco, in 2022. Those are the two things people have to have. Browns form the base for most breakfast items, including the Ken, which adds 3 eggs, a buttered and griddled biscuit smothered in bacon sausage gravy and thick-cut bacon or house-made sausages, the hash with house-made corned beef and green chili, and burritos large enough to feed a family of four. The latter feature 6 eggs, cheeses, and a choice of carne adobada, hatch green chili brisket, chorizo, sausage, or diced bacon. Born in Lordsburg, New Mexico, Sanchez grew up cooking with his grandmother and attended Le Cordon Bleu Cooking School in Scottsdale. He was working as executive chef at NASA's White Sands Test Facility near Las Cruces when the COVID-19 pandemic hit. Around that time, a friend bought a convenience store on Prescott's Sheldon Street. Sanchez came to help him get set up for food service, then fell for the town. "So I called Kathy and she came out 3 days later and we never went back," he says. "We set up shop in there and did really well." When Weckerly was looking to move to Wyoming, the couple saw an opportunity. "It was perfect for us," says Sanchez, who kept the menu but tweaked the recipes. "They liked that it was small and they liked the name. I always say, keep it simple," he says. In other words, stick to a few bold ingredients that work well together. In September, Be Simple added lunch menus resembling those bold ingredients into burgers, sandwiches, and salads. Lunch burritos and street tacos feature the same New Mexico-style options. If you dare, try the Ranch Hand, a half-pound burger piled with smoked brisket, pulled pork, bacon, and cheddar. Good food, generous portions, reasonable prices. Who could argue there aren't great things, or could be simpler? Be Simple is located at 220 South Montezuma Street in Prescott, Arizona. Phone number 928-515-3952. And this concludes Be Simple. L.M. Boyd is the author of Mary Adeline Norris Gray. In 1929, Mary Adeline Norris Gray took to the sky over Phoenix at the invitation of local aviators. It was the 83-year-old's first plane flight, but she wasn't intimidated. "It was better than being amongst all these reckless auto drivers," she told the Arizona Daily Star. The city, Gray said, had all changed since I first saw it, and that was truer for her than for just about anyone, because more than 6 decades earlier, Gray had become one of the first white women, and possibly the first, to settle in the Salt River Valley. She was born in Union County, Arkansas, in 1846, and married Columbus Lum Gray there in 1865. 3 years later, the two entered Arizona Territory by mule wagon en route to California, but they found unexpected green grass along the Salt River, where they stopped for what was meant to be a brief rest. Instead, the two put down roots in the tiny agricultural community. On the southwest corner of present-day 7th and Mojave Streets, Lum built one of the first permanent homes in Phoenix, an adobe farmhouse that soon was replaced by a brick structure. The couple's former slave, Mary Green, remained with the couple and is believed to have been the first black woman to settle in the area. The first farmers were called pumpkin eaters because for the first 5 years or so, about all we raised was pumpkins, watermelons, and vegetables, Gray recalled. Later, they added barley, corn, and cotton. Among their neighbors was city founder Jack Swilling, who Gray remembered as a handsome man with a twinkle in his eye and a fondness for liquor and morphine. The Grays had no children, but their Phoenix residence served as the region's social hub, hosting births, weddings, funerals, and dinner parties. And Gray rose to prominence as a civic leader and was instrumental in the building of Phoenix's first school and church. Lum died in 1905. In 1929, when the Daily Star interviewed Gray, she said she was hoping to make it to 100, but she died in 1936 at age 90. She's buried in Tempe's Double Butte Cemetery, about 5 miles southeast of the site of her former home in Phoenix. And this concludes Mary Adeline Norris Gray. This month, February in history, a bill to create Flagstaff's Northern Arizona Normal School was introduced in the territorial legislature on February 6, 1899. Today, the school is known as Northern Arizona University and has a total enrollment of 25,000. Coconino County, today the largest county in Arizona and second largest in the U.S. after California's San Bernardino County, was established on February 18, 1891. On February 27, 1998, the Arizona Diamondbacks played their first spring training game before their inaugural Major League Baseball season, beating the Chicago White Sox 6-5 at Tucson Electric Park. And that concludes This Month in History. Kelly Vaughn is the author of River Otter. Although river otters, Lantra canadensis, once were prevalent in Arizona's waterways, trapping, pollution, and habitat loss significantly reduced their populations. In the 1980s, scientists reintroduced the playful mammals, and they now can be found in streams, lakes, and rivers, including the Verde and Gila, along with the Salt River. The otters can propel themselves through water at speeds of up to 8 miles per hour, and they typically weigh between 10 and 33 pounds. Females are approximately one-third smaller than males. While river otters prefer to live solo or in pairs, otters are highly social creatures and communicate through whistles, buzzes, growls, and a variety of other vocalizations. Their diet consists primarily of small aquatic creatures such as fish, frogs, and insects, but they will, on occasion, eat other smaller animals. And this concludes River Otter. Noah Austin is the author of Warner Hotel. In the Warner Hotel's heyday, it housed workers from Bisbee's Mines. A stay in one of its original 25 rooms included breakfast in the morning, lunch to go, and dinner at night, owner Cole Van Norman says. It was a high-end boarding house, he adds. But when the city's mining operations shut down in the mid-1970s, the hotel, named for original owner Robert Warner, who built it in 1915, was forced to do the same. It sat vacant on Subway Street for nearly half a century, and when it caught Van Norman's eye during a visit around 2014, he assumed it had been a jail, given the bars and the windows. It's kind of hidden between buildings, he says, but I always wanted it. In 2020, Van Norman bought the Warner, and with the help of several family members, began a more than four-year overhaul that preserved elements of its history while giving today's guests a comfortable place to stay. The work included all new plumbing, air conditioning, and electrical, along with structural engineering to ensure the safety of the old building. 11 rooms now stand in place of the initial 25. Two of the cozy original rooms remain, and they are joined by 9 suites that offer varying amounts of additional space. And the boarding house days of sharing a few toilets are long gone. Each room has its own private bathroom, whether attached or just down the hall. Those hallways have retained their historical feel, and the renovation team also repainted the room doors and got their hardware working again. For the front entrance, we had only half of a double-sided door, so we were able to recreate the other half and make it look the same, Van Norman says. And the original dining room, kitchen, and caretaker's room have been refigured as Earl's Cafe, an inviting coffee shop named for Van Norman's grandfather. Since it opened in June 2024, the Warner has attracted people from Arizona and beyond, including staycationers from nearby Sierra Vista and tourists from Europe. It's particularly popular during events in town, including the Bisbee 1000, the stair climbing race, whose route runs right past the hotel. Regardless of where they come from or why, Van Norman hopes visitors get a feel for what Bisbee is now and what it used to be. This town is filled with Arizona history, he says. Coming here is about stepping back in time and realizing there was a different way at one time that people were living in Arizona. The Warner Hotel is located at 55 Subway Street in Bisbee. Phone number 520-222-6053. Website warnerhotel.com. And this concludes Warner Hotel. I'll conclude today's readings with a few letters to the editor from the February 2026 issue. Marguerite Ladd of Bisbee, Arizona wrote, "The remarks by your 1941 editor in Christmas Past, December 2025, touched my heart but also made me so sad because it seems that America has lost its pride, its courage, its honesty, and the goodness of its people. What have we done? And how do we return to our greatness? I do not mean to paint everyone with the same brush, but we are in trouble. I am a 93-year-old woman, and it pains me to my inner core to see the happenings in our land." David Gross of Duffer, Oregon wrote, "I read your December 2025 editor's letter with interest, as I do each month. Imagine my surprise to learn that you, too, opened your Christmas gifts on Christmas Eve. I am of 100% German blood, and that's the tradition I grew up with. I've never heard of anyone else who did that. I wish you a good holiday season and look forward to another year of your outstanding magazine." W. Scott Rainey of Prescott, Arizona wrote, "As a longtime fan of your magazine, I want to thank you for your editor's letter, October 2025, about the demise of the North Rim structures. I'm a resident of Prescott, and the North Rim has been a part of some of my fondest life memories, from launching room-to-room hikes to outback camping on the very edge. It was a destination beyond words. I gained a bit of solace after reading your beautiful tribute, just knowing that someone else had stared in disbelief with tears in their eyes over the tragedy. The natural beauty lives on. We'll just have to change our approach." And that concludes today's readings. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.